Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Welcome to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech radio show and podcast. I'm JP Nichols, sitting in for Brett one more week. He will be back next week. Today's show is coming to you pretty much from Boston at the eastern terminus of Interstate 90 in the northeastern United States, although I'm exactly on the other end on the western terminus in our studio in Seattle. So I had scheduled a special guest co-host, Gene Donnelly. Gene is the executive director of FinTech Sandbox, which is one of our sponsors today. Gene, in characteristic Boston terms, is stuck in a tunnel. She's going to try to join us later if she can, and I hope she does. I spent some time with Gene and our two guests today last week at FinTech Sandbox, so we've got a very interesting show. Well, let me tell you, first of all, about FinTech Sandbox. It's a nonprofit that serves fintech startups, gives them free access to quality financial data to accelerate product development. Along with their data access program, the Sandbox is a curated network of financial services leaders and decision makers that champion fintech entrepreneurs, bringing robust products to market and driving industry partnerships. You can get free data and get involved at fintechsandbox.org. And today's show is also brought to you by our friends at the Digital Banking Report, Jim Marus and Company. Bank and credit union executives and solution providers from more than 300 companies worldwide use insights from the Digital Banking Report to keep pace with digital transformation and financial services and make changes inside their own organization. You can save $500 off an annual subscription by using the coupon code BREAKINGBANKS upon checkout at digitalbankingreport.com. So today's show is about taming the student loan debt. Student loan debt now totals $1.5 trillion, second only to mortgage debt, and it's a crushing burden for many. So on today's show, we're going to talk to Laurel Taylor, who's the founder and CEO of FutureFuel.io, and Nick Dukoff, founder and CEO of Edmit.me. They're both taking a unique approach to taming the student loan beast that goes beyond just traditional consolidation and refinancing. And both are also members of FinTech Sandbox. And Gene, I hear that you've maybe dialed in on the other side of the tunnel. Are you with us? And can
yes. Hi, JP. Happy to be here. Yes, we just made it out of the tunnel, so I was able to call. So thank you.
That is such a Bostonian thing, out of the big dig. So before I go on to conference announcements and some news, give us a preview. At least just from your perspective, what is FinTech Sandbox, and how is it that Laurel and Nick have come to join your community?
Yeah, sure thing. So FinTech Sandbox helps early stage startups get access to data to build products. So what we've really done is tried to pull together a community that, as we look forward in the solutions that we want in financial services in the future, and helping startups to help us get there faster. And so we're a nonprofit that has a network of about 37 data partners who will give access to their premium data sets for free to the startups that we vet. And so what we're really trying to do is to kind of accelerate the innovation in the industry and help startups get those products to market, whether they be partnering with financial institutions or direct to consumer. So, and we've been fortunate enough to be able to work with both Laurel and Nick, you know, in terms of Future Fuel and Edmit, who are really addressing some critical problems that we have today, especially around paying for college and student debt.
Great, thanks. Well, I'm going to go through just a couple of conference announcements and a couple of news stories that caught my eye, and then we'll bring Laurel on, and you can help me introduce her. So next week, July 6th through the 13th in London, is FinTech Week. This is where the world of fintech comes to the world's fintech capital. Hoping to enhance the dialogue between established multinationals, innovation firms, disruptive startups, governments, media, and investors, August 9th is Block Legal, the premier legal conference for blockchain and crypto in Chicago. More info at fintechs.org. That's F-I-N-T-E-X. August 19th is Toronto FinTech Day, so check that out at fintechcanada.com. And as we get through the summer, we get into the fall conference season, big one coming up in Orlando, October 9th through 11th. It's BAI Beacon, the financial services conference that's designed to take industry goals and challenges and break them down into actionable steps that are right for your organization, your team, and you. Both Jason Hendricks and I will be there as FinTech Forge puts on a kind of a rare public version of our very popular innovation workshop as we help financial institutions go beyond the hype of the FinTech petting zoo, as Jason likes to call it, and actually work on getting things done. I will also be serving as host and moderator for the BAI Global Innovation Awards. You can register there at BAI.org. And if you have something you want to share with our audience, hit us up on Twitter at BreakingBanks1 or email us at info@provoke.fm. Just a couple things in the news. First, I want to give a shout out to friend of the show and sponsor Avoca. They just won Red Herring's Top 100 Award for North American Startups. If you haven't listened to Brett's interview with Avoca's Derek Corcoran, you can find that at provoke.fm. Bento for Business, which is a member of FinTechs, the nonprofit community in Chicago that Jason is so involved in, they just announced today, $9 million investment raise led by Edison Partners. Existing investor Comcast Ventures and new investor Mission OG also participated in the round. They've got a platform that offers APIs, virtual and debit cards, and white label capabilities, and they're really focused on business banking. We have talked so much about consumer banking here and hinted that we're still in the super early stages of commercial and business applications, and I think Bento for Business is going to be one of those we keep our eye on. We have also talked a lot on the show about Alipay and Ant Financial, and we noted several weeks ago that the U.S. would not allow them to acquire MoneyGram. Well, now they're announcing their own blockchain-based remittance service. So they're going to start just between Hong Kong and Philippines through a partnership between Alipay HK and GCash. Standard Charter will act as the settlement bank, and all three parties will act in parallel over a shared ledger, which will enable the verification and execution of the payment to occur simultaneously. Alibaba's founder, Jack Ma, says he wants to make it possible for people to remit even 1 cent at also almost no cost. Compared with the high fees charged by traditional remittances, well, like MoneyGram, he actually says in his quote, "At the time, we wanted to buy MoneyGram and overhaul it to help people all over the world to solve this issue." So he said this at the launch event. "Due to reasons from the U.S., our deal with MoneyGram did not succeed. So I said, let's make one better than MoneyGram, meaning. So let's use the most advanced technology." So pretty interesting. And finally, the last bit in the news, I think, sets us up today for our show. There's an article in Quartz late last week, actually, called "Student Debt is Killing Entrepreneurship." One poll cited in the article found that a majority of millennials would like to own a business someday, but fewer than 2% are self-employed. And it asked the question, is rising student loan debt levels at least partially to blame? Well, the devil's in the detail, right, Gene? Nationally, student loan debt has now reached $1.5 trillion, as I said at the top of the show. Now, that's up more than 150% in the last decade, and it's now nearly 1.5 times total credit card debt. A full 70% of college seniors graduate with debt. Nearly 30% of federal direct student loan dollars are in default, forbearance, or deferment. Between 2004 and 2014, there was an 89% increase in the number of student borrowers, as well as a 77% increase in the average balance held by them. So, Gene Laurel Taylor, founder and CEO of Future Fuel, is going to join us first. Now, they won the Payment and FinTech Accelerator Pitch Contest at South by Southwest. And Laurel's vision is to, quote, dramatically accelerate borrowers' ability to retire student debt by aligning interdependent parties in a novel way. The private sector's need to hire and retain top emerging talent with users' need to crush student loans. So, Gene, what else do you want to say about Laurel and Future Fuel before we ask her to join the show?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, Future Fuel, I think, is really leading the charge in terms of how to really try to address this issue, not just from one side of the marketplace, but really for both. So the combination of really helping the folks that are starting in the workforce and how to manage the debt that they have and find alternative solutions. But really combining that with the issue that you hit on the head there when you talk about talent and the ability to retain talent is a critical issue in the marketplace today. And I think you'll see with FutureFill and the solution that they've developed, it really addresses both sides of that equation. And really takes us forward when we think about the benefits that companies can offer and how to really address it. And I love her tagline of, crushing student debt.
Right. So, Laurel, welcome to the show. And tell us about your mission to, as you put it, democratize access to student loan repayment and refi as a new normal in employee benefits.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, JP. I'm thrilled to be here. And Gene, thank you for your many kind words. JP, I'm going to borrow from you in the future and call it the student loan devil, because I think that
is debt levels and talking too fast. Yes.
And no, I think it's perfect. It's absolutely it expresses what every user with student loan debt feels. So yeah, so we exist to crush student debt, as Gene shared. And our mission is to empower the user to move beyond debt and ultimately move into a state of wellness and into a state of wealth. And so as Gene spoke to, we believe that employers are increasingly becoming the distribution channel of financial solutions and services to consumers. And if you think about that, and we look at the benefit stack, the traditional benefit stack, what you see at the core of financial health and wellness offerings are tools like 401k, retirement, savings, maternity, paternity benefits, and those are health. Those are critical benefits. And yet, what we see today, those who are indebted, from millennials to parents, because we now have three generations of users in our workforce mm-hmm. who carry the distress or dis-ease of student loan debt. And so we see those users opting out of benefits that are really about wellness and wealth. When, as you shared, JP, we have 70% of our graduates who are actually playing the game of compound interest, but it's on debt, not mm-hmm. on wealth. The wrong way.
Yeah. So what are employers think about your approach? I mean, this is kind of novel. You're dragging them into the problem now, but yet they're responding pretty well. So tell us about what you're learning in your conversations with employers.
Sure. So employers are acutely aware of a struggle that they've been confronting for quite some time. And because of the tight labor market, the ability to acquire and retain talent has never been a greater challenge. So employers are awakening to the kind of the hard facts of nationwide average retention of millennials is 15 months. And employers are committed to diversity in the workforce. They are committed to our emerging workforce and becoming a destination of choice for talent in today's market. And quite frankly, are investing a tremendous amount of capital in waste in the system, which is really attrition. So 15-month average retention means hiring, training, that employee just becomes productive to churn out. And they're churning out because a bump of $5,000 in base pay is really attractive when your number one concern is your student loan debt. So they're already living the problem. I think now they're realizing that there's an opportunity to solve the problems they're already facing in a way that benefits both the enterprise as well as our emerging workforce. And again, even the leadership level, right, who are carrying student loan debt.
Right. So what's FutureFuel's role in the process? How do you work as a middleman between the employer employee to help crush the student debt?
Sure. So FutureFuel is a fintech and FinHealth enterprise SaaS platform that isn't enterprisey at all. We're consumer first and user first in all that we do. So it really feels like an app, actually. But what we do for the employer is fully assume the administrative burden of deploying a net new category of benefit offering. And so we appreciate that our customer, the employer, really expects technology that's mobile first, elegant, and that is stable, secure, reliable, and does all the work for them, right? So we onboard users, and from the process of signing up that user for repayment to taking that user through refinancing, we have a number of major product launches that are coming out in the fall. We just make it easy so that our buyer, the HR administrator, can get back to their million other priorities for the day.
Right. Are there certain industries or certain parts of the country where you're seeing more uptick than others?
We're seeing adoption of student debt, repayment to refinancing, student debt-centric benefits as a new normal across all industry verticals, across tech, financial services, retail. It's really proliferating in terms of adoption. And we're actually seeing the deployment of student debt-centric benefits for both what we might consider knowledge workers, those in science, technology, engineering, and math, where there is a terrific war for talent. We're also seeing student debt-centric benefits offered to that very first job you get out of college, where you may be in customer success, or you may be in various different roles within the organization. I think that's a really exciting trend, because our mission is to have the broadest scale and impact for all users in our economy. And the adoption started with STEM and healthcare professionals and industry verticals that are really hiring professions in those areas. But now it's becoming, we're seeing use cases that are spanning in many, many new areas of our labor market.
Yeah, I expected to hear more heavily in technology and those areas where the competition for talent is highest, but you're seeing it spread across to other industries as well.
We are.
Oh, that's great. So what are you hearing from employers about your approach? What are the benefits for the employer for helping them address this issue for their employees?
Sure. So there are four problems that we are being hired to solve through student debt-centric benefits. Acquiring, so the ability to acquire talent in the market at an efficient pace. So building a consistent quality pipeline of talent for the organization. Once that organization has been able to really solidify their position as a destination of choice, then it's about aligning incentives to drive retention. And again, the data show that 86% of users would work for an employer if that employer offered student debt-centric benefits for 3 to 5 years. So that's a dramatic change in behavior from an average of 15 months to 36 months or more. And the employer is at a break even just by extending loyalty by 2 months. If loyalty is extended by a year, that employer can fund the benefit for 14 other employees. Diversity is a key area of opportunity for almost every employer. And two-thirds of student loan debt, as you share, JP, $1.5 trillion, two-thirds of that student loan debt is held by women and minorities. So by offering student debt-centric benefits, you're really becoming a magnet for talent within diverse populations. And then finally, employee engagement and sentiment analysis, really looking for a lift in what we call love and loyalty. When you see your employer making an investment in you, where you are today, not where you're going to be in 10 to 15 years when you're really focused on wealth, we want to accelerate that, by the way. We want to accelerate that user's ability to engage in things like 401k much earlier in the lifespan of their career. But that really, the data show there's disproportionate return when employers deploy this net new category of offering.
Well, are you seeing that employees are participating less in 401ks because they have student loan debt? And if so, what's the impact on that to the companies too?
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting question. We are seeing that 60% of employees are opting out of 401k. So the data in the cross a wide variety of industry verticals. Now that poses a few challenges. Many organizations are finding themselves in a position where they're top heavy because they are not seeing adoption at the rates that they would have seen historically because of the unique attributes of our emerging workforce. Again, this has never existed in our economy of the scale that it is today. And to your point, JP, at $1.5 trillion, it's growing at $100 billion annually. So by the time millennials become 75% of our workforce by 2025, the attribute will almost be pervasive. So when we have top-heavy plans, the other issue that we're seeing, again, is lack of alignment in terms of employers work so hard to curate what is intended to be incredibly compelling for employee populations. And this new attribute of student debt has risen so rapidly that you see organizations calibrating around, okay, what is it that we do for this employee population? Because we have to rethink what is going to be compelling for this new segment of the population.
Yeah, and you talked about top-heavy plans. I mean, that's actually a IRS definition. Can you just very briefly explain what happens if your plan is top-heavy and what the impact is to the company?
Sure. So top-heavy plans essentially means that there is a disproportionate amount of participation in 401k at a certain level of income and above. Traditionally, it can be often at the management and leadership level, and those that may be that may not have reached that level of income are not participating. And so that can create all sorts of behaviors in terms of the inability for those participating in 401k to be able to participate at the maximum contribution level. It can also have financial penalties and other considerations,
right.
Other implications rather.
In other words, it can disincentivize some of other people, more higher paid employees, to contribute as much into the plan because there's tax consequences for doing that. And so that furthers their motivation to help, maybe more junior employees take care of their student loan debt and be able to participate in the plan.
That's right. And actually, the surveys that we deploy on behalf of our customers reveal that data, that those who are opting out have student loan debt. And if relief were offered around student loan debt, those same users would opt in. Mm-hmm. There's a very clear connection between the two, and that typically kind of raises some eyebrows the first time that a customer will see that data, because it's been incredibly consistent across the surveys that we've deployed.
Right. Well, Laurel, tell us a little bit about your background and why you decided to start Future Fuel.
Yes. So I decided to start Future Fuel because I have lived this story myself. It is not academic. It is visceral. Student loan debt is many users that I meet with. I've had users cry. I mean, it just feels like this kind of hopeless abyss. You're paying on average for 17 to 20 years. Mm. And it took me about 13 years to pay off my student loans. I've had $150,000 of student loan debt. And the moment that really punctuated for me the need to be a part and really drive a solution, and I think there will be many solutions that we will need to consider, I went to school at MIT, which was a lifelong dream of mine, and I was leading a global business unit for Google. I had a credit score north of 800, so it was not a thin file credit, and had a decent income. And I kind of naively thought, oh, let me see if I should take out a student loan, if it would make more sense. I was given a 9% interest rate. Mm. So, I just thought, if I'm receiving a 9% interest rate, what is everybody else getting?
Right.
And so that was the moment, that really was the moment for me where I decided to be a part of the solution and innovate our way out of this. And that's really the relationship with the private sector. It's really a modern day GI Bill that we're issuing.
Interesting. Well, tell us about where you are as a company, kind of what stage and what you've learned so far. When did you found the company and kind of where, what's the stage you're at now?
Sure. Founded the company in 2016. And so I cannot believe that it has been over 2 years.
It goes fast.
And it does. It does go fast. It's been it's been exhilarating. It's been challenging. It's been a great blessing. This is my path and purpose in life. We have an amazing team of 11. We are grinding every day to be of service to our users and to I think your first question, to make this a new normal so that student debt-centric benefits are just as prolific as 401k, and we're very clear on the mission and why we exist, and we have we are getting ready for a very big fall, and we're going through a really exciting period of growth, which is awesome.
Well, that is great. And why are you at FinTech Sandbox? What's the advantage for you being there, and what kind of data have you leveraged to build Future Fuel?
Yes, well, we are a huge fan of the FinTech Sandbox and so grateful to Jean and Sarah Biller and David Yeagan and Tatiana. So we started our relationship with FinTech Sandbox and found our way to one of our most critical partners, which is Quovo, and Lowell Putnam is their CEO. And we have a number and have had a number of problems to solve because of the student loan servicer space. They have some unique challenges in terms of being able to access data at the individual level. So we have created a hyper-personalized user experience for our users so that when they engage in our offering, we're able to pull the metadata of each and every student loan of that user. So the loan with Navient, the balance, the interest rate, the payment behavior, we're able to see when payments post. So when we actually facilitate and administer the benefit of student debt repayment and we move money from the employer directly to the student loan of that particular user, we also need to close the loop on the payments. So upfront, from a KYC and AML perspective, we need to ensure that a user is associated with a specific student loan. We want to ensure that's a non-zero balance. We process the payments. We see when they post. We can close that loop real time with both the employer and the user. And that's a particularly gnarly challenge to solve in this space. And Quovo really discovered, and our partnership through the FinTech Sandbox was the first major milestone for us in terms of data and partnership, and it's been a terrific relationship for us, and just so thrilled to be part of the Sandbox. It's just one example of how we're working together.
Well, we've talked a lot on the show about the power of data and the need for data and how it is quickly becoming a differentiator between the winners and the losers. So the ability to consume that data and be able to build your business on top of it sounds like it was a major advantage for you.
Indeed. It's really operationalizing the benefit. Absolutely.
Now, I do not know Lowell Putnam. Never had the opportunity to meet. I assume that's Mr. Putnam?
Yes, but, it is.
Okay.
Yes.
I didn't want to be gender biased here. But
Thank you for that.
But I do want to say, if there ever was a name that was made up in Boston, it would be Lowell Putnam. Right? That's such a Bostonian name. Is he a Bostonian?
You know, I don't know. I know that he's in New York now, but I think that he might be. I'm looking him up right now because I don't remember originally where he's from.
When I write my FinTech, graphic novel, that'll be the character based in
Well,
Boston.
He did go to school at Harvard, so we got to knock him for that anyway.
Well, yeah, you Cambridge people can fight over that. Well, I'm going to take us to break here in just a minute. Jean, any last thoughts here from your perspective on Future Fuel?
Yeah, no, I think, like I said, I'm so impressed with Laurel and what they've done and what they've built. I do have one question for Laurel, Isaac. If you were to look 5 years in the future, or even 10 years in the future, in terms of addressing the student debt, what would look different, from an employer perspective? Like, how would they be looking at things differently, do you think?
Ooh. That's an exciting question. So we really do see the employer becoming the central hub of financial services and solutions for consumers, users at large. What we've learned is that users really trust their employer, and they're already engaged with that employer for many of what we would consider traditional financial services that we're consuming. So we are already working with employers around the ability to leverage their own balance sheet to offer advantage services and solutions. Mm-hmm. We are a platform strategy. Employers do not want to be banks. They do not want to deal with administrative deployment of solutions, but as a platform strategy, we assume that burden because that is a core opportunity to create impact at scale and also, again, solve the four problems we're being hired to solve: acquire, retain, drive diversity, and employee engagement. And we see that relationship between those two parties is really exciting opportunity to lever the data that the employer has and the data we have that user right. provides to us to transform access in an intelligent, good. Targeted way.
Jean, good question. Laurel, good answer. I'm going to have to leave it here because we have to go to a break. But Laurel Taylor from futurefuel.io, we've got her particulars out on Twitter, and you can go to futurefuel.io. This show is also brought to you today by The Financial Revolutionist, which has been named one of the best tech newsletters by Business Insider. It's written every week by co-founder Greg Schoenberg, and it's been referred to as the fintech newsletter that's not just about fintech. That's because in addition to fintech, it touches on a wide range of financial innovation topics, crossover into politics, healthcare, changing nature of the workforce, which is what we're talking about here today, history and popular culture. You can subscribe at thefr.com. So it's time to take a short break, and then we'll be right back with more Breaking Banks.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
Have you become a member yet? Sign up now to become a member of Voice America. It's always free and easy. Plus, you get to take advantage of some great member benefits. Get unlimited access to millions of hours of on-demand content across all of our channels. Keep track of your favorite episodes, shows, and hosts in your own customizable library. Find out what shows you might be interested in based on your favorites. Plus, you get insider access with our newsletter. Membership gives you more. Sign up at voiceamerica.com and click register at the top right.
Now, before we get back to talking about fintech, I want to take a quick moment to tell you about eFinancialCareers.com, one of the supporters of the show. They're the world's leading career site for financial service professionals for over 15 years. eFinancialCareers.com partners with leading financial and fintech firms, so your resume is seen by all the top companies and recruiters in the U.S. and abroad. Now, as we all know, financial services is a very dynamic, ever-changing industry, and eFinancial Careers provides valuable resources from helpful career coaching to interview strategies and tools that keep you up to speed and well-informed with what's happening now in the industry and what it means for your career. Registration's free for financial professionals. Make sure you take advantage of all the resources they have to offer. So check them out, eFinancialCareers.com.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
Well, welcome back to Breaking Banks. Today, we're talking about taming the student loan beast with my special guest co-host, Jean Donnelly, Executive Director of FinTech Sandbox. And we've got coming up Nick Dukoff, who's the founder and CEO of Edmit. That's at edmit.me. And before the break, we were talking with Laurel Taylor of Future Fuel, which is helping students better manage and pay down their student debts. But Nick, you're actually working to help students take on less debt to begin with. And Gene, maybe any thoughts or introduction for Nick before he tells us a little bit about how Edmit works?
I just love the theme. If we talked about, like you said, how student loans are an issue, and it's really about how do we stop the problem from starting to begin with. And I think Nick and his team at Edmit have done a fantastic job, and also very proud that they're also another Boston-based startup that's a part of the FinTech Sandbox. We've been very fortunate to work with Nick and his team.
Oh, that's great. Well, Nick, welcome to the show. Tell us about Edmit.
Thank you, JP and Gene. Really happy to be here. So at Edmit, our software and advising network provides personalized, data-driven advice to help families understand the true cost and overall value of different colleges. Families that use EdMIT make smarter college choices, leading to less debt and better earnings outcomes, with our family saving an average of over $5,000.
So tell us about how it works.
We make it extremely simple to search for great schools based on a family or student's academic merit and financial fit. We help them prioritize by things that are really important considerations like graduation rate and earnings, loan amount, default rate, and help nudge students and their families to take actions towards more rational behavior. This is a highly emotional decision. It's impossible to fully extract the emotion from the rationalization, but we're doing our part to help people make better financial decisions as it relates to college.
Well, maybe you can explain it best with a little bit of a case study. You've got a few different case studies of students and their parents who you've helped them kind of make better financial decisions, which meant they ended up with less student loan debt or student devil. Is that what we're calling it now? So walk us through maybe an example of how this has worked for some of your customers.
Yeah, so the devil, as you say, is in the details. So colleges that might look similar to parents and students based on things like their rankings by U.S. News and World Report or other data that may be available may have completely different financial and merit aid philosophies that could lead to drastically different costs to the end user. For example, one of our customers this year applied to both Villanova and Fordham, which in the U.S. News and World Report rankings look quite similar, very similar mm-hmm. sticker price, very similar post-graduation earnings outcomes. You know, they're 40, 50 miles apart. And yet when you dig into the data, it becomes very clear that Fordham's average net price is lower for higher income families. This is because Villanova uses its financial and merit aid primarily for need-based awards, for folks that really need the financial aid to be able to attend, whereas Fordham discounts across all income levels and, according to the data that we have, increasingly towards higher earners. So for a family that's in the top quintile for household income, we actually saw that family receive $60,000 more in aid from Fordham than Villanova.
Wow. That's significant.
It's incredible.
Yeah. So are you taking need-based financial aid into consideration as well?
Absolutely. We take the student's academic profile as well as the household financial profile to create our trademarked EdStimate for that student. And the EdStimate consists of, for that student, what we think they're likely to pay at a given college and also what we think they're likely to earn post-graduation at a given college.
Okay, so there are a number of tools out there that will help students and parents look at what they qualify for from a needs basis, right, with their income and assets and all of this. But once you start getting into how are universities utilizing their merit-based scholarship pools, that's much murkier waters, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's almost impossible for students and families to understand the true cost of college or compare different colleges apples to apples. The data's there, but it's pretty difficult for a typical parent or student who doesn't have a PhD in data science to make sense of it. Again, you know, hardly anybody pays the sticker price, but similarly, very few people pay the average. And what a lot of sites have is either, you know, data around what college's sticker price is or what the average student pays there. But what people really care about and what they need to know is what they will pay.
First of all, maybe I'll just stick with that for one second. And so you gave an example of, you know, school that offered $60,000 more in aid. And first of all, what did the family do with that data?
Well, for them, even though the student had really had their heart set on Villanova, ration prevailed, and the student is enrolled at Fordham for this upcoming school year.
How often does rationality actually prevail? Because we're not rational animals, as you know.
No, we're not. But as the recent Nobel Prize winner, Thaler, and his research around nudges have demonstrated, yes, you can move people towards more rational behavior. And, you know, there's a lot in play there. And, you know, we're just trying to do our little part. Right now, students often apply to too few schools or a suboptimal mix of schools and then often end up enrolling in a suboptimal school. And this is known in the industry as undermatching. You know, students are underweighing quality indicators like graduation rate and earnings and debt, while overweighing non-quality factors like convenience, distance from home, you know, the feeling that they get when they visit the campus. And also people anchor to a college's sticker price, overestimating how much college will actually cost them, and they'll preemptively conclude that that college may be out of reach. And so again, you know, we're just trying to take these basic and natural consumer behavioral tendencies and present, you know, very intuitive information that can help nudge families towards more rational decision making, which hopefully decreases their debt and increases their earnings over time.
So are you using Taylor and Tversky's nudge findings to help these people make better decisions, or are you just showing them the data, or are you actually trying to nudge them towards, you know, what your data objectively says is a better decision?
We're absolutely using the behavioral science to bring to bear on this problem. Our new version of the software, which we'll be releasing shortly after the 4th of July, will include recommendations that are in line with the consumer experience. So we'll really be taking, you know, things like loss aversion and other behavioral traits into consideration to help move folks towards more rational decision making.
Hmm. And so the other factor that you mentioned is earnings potential. How accurate is that data? Do you really have a good handle on you know, how much more I'm going to earn if I go to University B instead of A?
We're working on it. So we're working with a researcher at Temple University to build out a really rich data around college by earnings by major and over time. So we're tracking this over 14 years post-graduation. So we're able to show folks certainly directionally the shape and slope of the earnings curve for that student for a given college and a given major.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I went through this with my own daughter a few years ago, and it seems like prospective college students and their parents both have an insatiable appetite for data that help them make their college decisions. There are endless number of rankings. Why is there such a disconnect when it comes to understanding what they should actually expect in terms of total cost and total return on their investment in terms of their future earnings?
The research would show that the information is out there, but it's often presented in a way that isn't particularly helpful to consumers. Mm-hmm. You know, you were speaking about some of the research, and the consideration can just become overwhelming. And also, there's so many tactical things the family has to do in a given time frame that becomes overwhelming. And so we try to really break it down and make it simple. Here are the, you know, small number of things that you can do that are going to have the biggest impact on your future.
Hmm. So tell us about your background and why you decided to start Edmit.
Sure. My co-founder, Sabrina Manville, and I were both university administrators who saw firsthand how important clearly communicating cost and value were. Most recently, I was vice president for new ventures at Northeastern University here in Boston, and Sabrina was AVP of marketing at Southern New Hampshire University, a very well-regarded nonprofit up the road in New Hampshire with a great online program. Mm-hmm. And both of our institutions kind of came from different ends of the spectrum. Southern New Hampshire is just a tremendous value because of its cost, and Northeastern is a tremendous value because of its career outcomes and earnings potential.
And kind of famous for their engineering co-ops, right?
Absolutely. In fact, co-op is available to all students at all majors. Even still, communicating and articulating, you know, the cost and value was very difficult. You know, it just gets lost in a sea of marketing and advertising in higher education. A big part of the rising cost of higher education is actually coming from increased marketing expense. It's becoming you know, very expensive. In some cases, the cost of acquisition is as much as $8,000 to $10,000 for these colleges. And so, you know, in our roles, seeing how hard it was to communicate cost and value, we really began to think about it from the consumer's perspective, which is, if it's hard to communicate that, think about how hard it is to receive it as the consumer. Everyone's trying to kind of tell you why they're so great, you know, what this college is going to cost, why it's going to be such a great investment for you. At the end of the day, though, consumers have a really hard time parsing through all of that. And so we built Edmit to hopefully make it really easy.
Mm. So when did you start the company, and how far along are you now?
We started the company this past fall, 2017. We raised a small pre-seed round of $1 million, built a terrific team of 5 full-time folks. We've served thousands of families in our first run, which ran from December to May, and we're gearing up to really go big and hopefully impact and help as many families as possible in this upcoming year.
Well, that's great. Well, what have you learned so far since launch, and especially maybe was there anything that really surprised you so far in your journey?
That's a great question. I think the biggest thing that I've really learned and is that this isn't just a student debt problem. Mm-hmm. Since 1990, parent borrowing is up 300%, while undergraduate student borrowing is only up 60%. Earlier this month, Politico wrote about the AARP focusing on student debt as a core issue because it's pushing retirement back for Generation X. You know, the student debt problem is pervasive, and it's a really important thing to tackle, and I'm so glad Laurel, Future Fuel, and others are doing that. But parent borrowing in this category and, you know, kind of all of these other financial considerations upstream are really important to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a trillion here, a trillion there. Pretty soon we're talking about real money, and our regular contributor, Theo Lau, you know, spent some time working with AARP and some of these senior issues, and she's talked about how these generational issues do overlap and impact one another. So we'll have her back on the show to talk more about that. But let me ask you again, though, was that the big surprise, or was there something, was there an assumption that you had when you started the company that turned out to not be true so far?
I think the assumption was that student was our customer.
Ah, I see.
And I think we've really found that it's the parent and the mom specifically who's doing most of the financial research as it relates to the college decision, and then bringing that back to the dinner table.
Hmm. So with the parents being more involved in the decision than you thought, is that a pull towards more rationality or less rationality? In other words, those nudges that you talked about before, do you need them more with parents or with students?
You know, it's funny. I think there are different considerations. I'll give you another anecdote. Mm-hmm. We had a family in the greater Boston area who the student had applied to a number of colleges and had been accepted to Fitchburg State, which is a regional public school, as well as 2 great private schools, WPI, Worcester Polytechnic Institute, and Merrimack College. Mm-hmm. And the dad really wanted the son to go to the state school because it was considerably less expensive. I think in the order of magnitude of $50,000, $60,000 less expensive over 4 years. Wow. And the mom and student were really having a hard time articulating to the dad why it made sense to, you know, take a bit bigger bite and a little bit bigger risk to attend Merrimack or WPI. And our tool helped them make the argument that the earnings were going to be considerably greater. If I recall correctly, Merrimack and WPI had about $300,000-$400,000 greater earnings over that 14-year period that we measure than the state school. So there are very few investments that a middle-class family can make to turn 50, 60K into 300K over 14 years.
Mm. So in this case, the more expensive school was worth it because there were greater earnings potential.
Exactly.
Interesting. So where do you get your data, and how do you leverage the data sources that are available to you at FinTech Sandbox?
Well, we get our data from a variety of different sources. Thankfully, the government produces some great data in the iPEDS and College Scorecard. We also license data from a variety of folks, including Peterson's. And then we collect data from scraping all sorts of websites, as well as first-party data that consumers give us. You know, we like to think about ourselves to some extent as Glassdoor for college, where students are telling us what they actually paid, what they earn, helping build that data set to help others that come after them. With respect to FinTech Sandbox, we're so privileged to be part of it. We're relatively new and are in the process of integrating Quovo to be able to hook our customers' 529 savings and student loan accounts into our software, and also using Moody's ratings to help assess college viability. A big story here in the local news recently was Mount Ida closed. It's a Massachusetts private school and was acquired by UMass. And we want to help identify and pull forward risk factors to help families make decisions that are going to have big consequences. So those are just a couple of the examples of how we're going to be integrating data from FinTech Sandbox.
Wow. So Lowell Putnam and Cuomo strike again. So I hope you'll forgive me for teasing about his very Boston-sounding name. Please tell me you have an advisor named something like Quincy Brookline.
Sure.
Oh, that's good. So where do you go from here? You talked a little bit about this, but tell us a little bit more about what we can expect in the future. What kind of other features and benefits are you going to add to EdMIT?
Yeah, so we really think about ourselves as AAA for higher education, in the sense of, you know, we want to be their roadside assistance for your financial questions, your quote dumb financial questions. No, you know, no question is dumb, and people are often afraid to ask, and you know, because they don't ask, they get caught in these unfortunate traps. And we really want to be the site of record to help families make better college choices, leading to less debt and better earnings outcomes.
Mm. That's great. So, Gene, any last thoughts or questions before, believe it or not, we've come almost to the end of the show already. It's been a great one.
Wow, it's gone by really fast. The only other thing, Nick, I wanted, because having been able to see the tool and see how helpful it is and how you can iterate and do different scenarios, do you also see, you know, it's not like the use of it ends after that decision is made. I think we talked a little bit, there are other ways you can use the tool, like if you're thinking about transferring or further on in the process. Is that something that you've looked at as well?
Thanks so much, Gene, for asking that question. Yeah, 30% of students transfer. And this is also a category that has just massive consumer dissatisfaction. 51% of college graduates say they would change either their college or major if they could do it over again. Also, students have to reapply for the FAFSA and their student loan every year. So our software is absolutely helpful, not only kind of in making the decision, but making sure you optimize it while you're in school.
Wow, fascinating. Well, listen, Nick Dukoff from EdMIT.me, thank you for joining us, and thanks for telling your story. And also thanks to Laurel Taylor again from FutureFuel.io. Again, we've tweeted out their contact information. You can go to both of those websites and also go to FinTechSandbox.org. So, Gene, thanks for joining with me today. Thanks for bringing two of your very, very cool members on the show. We'll definitely have you back again. And I'm going to stay in the Boston area at the very end here to give Ron Shevlin the last word. He's got a moment of snark coming up as he continues the conversation we've been having, both on the show and online and offline, about Venmo versus Zelle. And I know we say this after every show, but if you like the show, please do give us a 5-star rating. In fact, you can do it right now. I'll wait. We've been getting such great feedback on the show, and it really helps others if that feedback is public, so that they can find and share the shows on their favorite podcast platform. So if you do the same, we'll really appreciate it. We are coming up on our 250th episode in a few weeks, and you can listen to all of them, plus episodes from FinTech 5 with Jason Hendricks, my own Serial Entrepreneur podcast, Breaking Banks Asia Pacific with Simon Spencer, all at provoke.fm. Brett King will be back next week with more Breaking Banks. But until then, I'll leave it with Ron Shevlin and this week's Moment of Snark.
Zelle is a pretty hot topic among banks and credit unions these days as they try to decide whether or not to provide the service to their customers and members. According to eMarketer, by the end of this year, Zelle will overtake Venmo in number of users, and by 2022, will have roughly 56 million users compared to a projected 39 million Venmo users. And in fact, according to the companies themselves, Zelle's transaction volume has exceeded Venmo's for the past 2 years, which I find a bit surprising when you consider that, technically speaking, Zelle didn't even launch until 2017. Should banks and credit unions care that Zelle transaction volume and user count is going to be big? Is that enough to get them to join the Zelle bandwagon? In other words, is there a business case here for Zelle? I don't see it on the revenue side. No bank or credit union is currently charging users to use Zelle, or plans to, as far as I know, which isn't surprising given banks' horrendous track record at charging for P2P transactions. The cost side of the equation is pretty shaky, too. Zelle costs banks more than they would have to pay for a service like Pop Money, and a bank or credit union whose digital banking platform isn't integrated with Zelle has to incur development costs to be able to offer it. So much for a cost reduction rationale. Now, one analyst thinks there could be an engagement play here. Writing in the financial brand, Celent's Bob Mira believes that if banks can keep their users engaged, then they have more of an opportunity to cement and grow relationships with customers. Bob wrote, "Every time PayPal or Square or Venmo takes a customer interaction away from a bank, that's engagement a bank doesn't have with its customers." But is there any evidence that existing Venmo users have switched banks or not cemented their relationships with their existing banks? I've got data that shows that the large banks, who have been without Zelle until recently, have done quite well cementing their relationship with millennials who comprise a large portion of Venmo users. Now, the bigger risk to banks and credit unions is the deposit displacement caused by P2P services. Deposit displacement is the diversion or displacement of funds away from traditional bank accounts into other types of accounts. Deposit displacement is caused by things like health savings accounts, robo-advisor tools, merchant apps like Starbucks, and of course, P2P apps. Venmo users have more than $2 billion sitting in their Venmo accounts, $2 billion that used to sit in their checking accounts. And as I'm sure you know, Apple's P2P service keeps transactions in what is effectively an Apple prepaid account, not putting the money back in the user's checking account. The revenue and cost components of the business case for Zelle look pretty weak. But if banks and credit unions can use Zelle to stem the tide of deposit displacement, then offering the service may be worth their while. I'm Ron Shevlin, and this is the Moment of Snark on Breaking Banks.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.